There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
From John Ronson to James Dashner, Jane Austen to Zadie Smith, this is Talking of Books on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Welcome back to Talking of Books. We're here talking about the Man Booker Prize and who we think is going to win it this year. We've had a lot of debate in the studio, a lot of fisticuffs. There are some Marmite views on some of the books. The next one that we've got to talk about is A History of Wolves by Emily Friedland. I had the opportunity to talk to her the other day. This is the interview. One thing I really want to talk about is the title, because I think the first thing that really hooked me was History of Wolves. It's a great title, and it's highlighted when we're reading about the History Odyssey project. So the protagonist decides to call it The History of Wolves. Can you talk a bit about what exactly her fascination with wolves stands for in the novel as a whole?
So you're right. I think you're right to go back to that first chapter and her History Odyssey project. That's where the title comes from.
Is there another way of looking at the references to wildness in the novel as well? So not just wolves, but talking about the setting. Because as I was reading this, I felt like the setting was a character in its own right. And I found parallels between the environment and, say, the people, the community's own lack of warmth and comfort. Maybe I don't know if I'm reading too much into this. I mean, how much did you intend for that to happen?
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense to me. You know, in a lot of ways, Linda is a wild character, a feral character. She's raised in this back-to-land-style commune that breaks up when she's really young. And essentially, you know, she raises herself. She's out in the woods by herself most of the time. Her parents have to, you know, live off of the land and do what they can to survive, and as does Linda. And so much of the book, for me as a writer, was kind of figuring out how to express the interiority of this character, Linda, without actually having her describe her interior life. And that meant for me as a writer to write about the external landscape, to write about her encounters with the external world, because she's not a person who really talks about her feelings very much. Instead, you know, to get at the internal world for me as a writer, I had to write about how she touched her dogs and how she interacted with the lake and the trees. Separation between interior and external in the book is not very firm for Linda.
I want to talk about the ending. So in a coming-of-age novel, I'm accustomed to, say, a moment of revelation at the end. And if anything, when I was reading it, I felt that she was more confused than she was at the beginning. And what did you intend with the open ending? And am I right in thinking that there's quite a lot of revenge there, or did you not intend that?
Yeah, I think you're right. I do think you're right. So I originally thought of the ending as the penultimate chapter, which shows Linda sort of wandering through the town looking for help. And I finished that, and I really felt like there was something left, some kind of residual anger and sadness in Linda that needed outlet, that required outlet of some sort. And so that sort of led me to work on the final chapter of the book. You know, she's so rejected by Patra, the woman that she has been a babysitter for. She's working in this family. Patra is the mother. And she's been rejected and sort of abandoned in the aftermath of the trial and is angry about that. And that sort of leads her to lash out, to reach out to Lily, another character in the book. And I guess I was just thinking a lot about how the events that happen in one part of a life influence the events in another, that they change how we think about the events in the other parts of our lives, and they're not cordoned off, right? So what happens for Linda in this little family unit that she becomes a babysitter for doesn't end when that family leaves town. She has to go on and live a life. And so not only does that lead her to kind of lash out and reach out towards Lily at the end in the way that I write about.
I noticed that as I was reading this, we weren't necessarily presented with a cast of heroes and villains. Everybody was very much in certain grey areas or allowed the reader to feel empathy for them. The comment, it's not what you think, but what you do. How much of that is kind of what the novel is all about?
Yeah, so to your first part of the question, it was very important to me to think about all of these characters with a certain amount of empathy, and also to not let them off the hook. So all of these characters, I think, ideally, are neither perfectly good nor perfectly bad. You know, they're all capable of goodness, and they're also all capable of doing real harm to each other. And I wanted to show that. And so that was very important to me. And so not just Linda, but also Patra, the mother, and Leo, the father, and Linda's own parents, and Mr. Grierson, the pedophile, all of these people are potentially have the capacity for being good, and also even through their goodness and their desire to be good, have done terrible things, which is, I think, what happens sometimes with religious ideology. That maybe is an answer to the first part of the question. The second part of the question was about the idea of it's not what you do, but it's not what you think, but what you do that matters.
Yeah.
That line comes in a paragraph that actually has the opposite in the beginning of the paragraph. So in the beginning of that paragraph, there is Linda sort of thinking about this church service that she's attended, and she has heard a line, and she's repeating it in her head, and that line is, it's not what you do, but what you think that matters. And through the course of her thinking in that paragraph, the logic of that line changes, in fact, becomes the opposite. It's not what you think, but what you do that matters. And what I was playing with how those that notion can be justified based on what you want to think, essentially. So for certain characters in the book, the fact is they want to believe it's what you think and not what you do. That really matters, especially the characters who are basing their thinking on religion and religious ideology. For Mr. Grierson, he wants to believe it's not what you think, not what's in your head, but what you do that matters. And Linda's sort of toggling back and forth between those two possibilities. And I just wanted to show that they're actually not that different in a way, and that we actually justify our own ethics, whether it matters what we think or what we do, you know, kind of based on our own context more than anything else.
And we've talked about the ending, and I want to go back to the beginning very briefly. And I want to know whether the idea for this, was it something that came to you fully formed one day? Or is it something that's kind of been percolating, or an idea that's been accumulating over time?
That's a really good question. Some of the larger pieces of the book, you know, I'm not revealing too much in saying that a child dies. So that basic movement of the book was something I knew I wanted to do from the very beginning. And I knew that I wanted to explore, as I said before, the relationship of thought to action and some of these ethical quandaries, and also the relationship of memory to perception, and you know how we experience things in the moment changes as we think about it over time and as we remember it and look back on it. And so we tell different stories at different points in our lives about the events that occur. So I was thinking about all of these things, and that being said, a lot of the smaller movements in the book only came to me through the writing. I'm a writer who writes kind of based on the sentences more than sort of large plot development. So I don't develop a really fixed outline. I love thinking about the rhythm of sentences and kind of listening for the sound of the music of, you know, a few words strung together and using that as a way to get to the next set of sentences and the next set of paragraphs, etc. So it was a very organic process in the composition of the book initially, while having sort of a larger idea of some basic thought movements in my head. Mostly I was listening to the sentences. That being said, I did, you know, once I had a draft, I did go back and do a lot of kind of piecing together of different plot moments or sections and kind of moving pages around on the floor, actually printing things off and trying to arrange things carefully. But the initial composition was rather organic.
This is your debut novel, but what would be your advice to aspiring writers who are listening?
The thing about this book is that I didn't think very much at all about publication as I was writing it. I'd written stories for a long time and, you know, published some of those, but had no sense of a readership. You know, they were published in tiny little literary magazines, and I didn't know if anybody read them at all. I think that was really helpful. Just the idea of writing the thing that you care about most and the thing that fascinated you most, me most, I should say, without thinking about publication. Because if I had thought about publication, I may not have written this book, to be honest, or I would have written a different kind of book. And I, you know, it's not a perfect novel, but I often think that the risks that it takes are related to, and the ambition that it has potentially are related to its the unusual way that I wrote it. And if I had tried to write a more conventional book, or if I had tried to write a book thinking about publication or what other people thought of it, I'm not sure it would have been as interesting, honestly.
Well, it was...
So I guess the advice that I would give is, you know, write the thing that you care about most and try to scrub the idea of publication from your brain while you're writing, and then only worry about that later if you can.
Emily, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me, because you have a very busy schedule, and I hope that you enjoy the rest of the Booker experience.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you for your thoughtful question.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.